content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. I'd like to start with an article from AARP The Bulletin, a Q&A with Bob Odenkirk. I like the next thing to do that I do to be 180 degrees from what I just did. Actor, comedian, director, and writer, Bob Odenkirk, 63, is on a mission to try it all. Your career has been incredibly diverse, as seen in your new movie, Normal, premiering last April, in which you play an action hero. Was that by choice? My career makes no sense. It's true. I started as a comedy writer with my total commitment to being that for the rest of my life. I always liked performing, and I acted all through that time. Then came the strange moment around age 44 when I was invited to be in the hit AMC crime series Breaking Bad. From there, this new career grew into drama acting and bigger roles. How much did playing Saul Goodman in Breaking Bad and later in the spinoff Better Call Saul change your life? Saul Goodman was a huge role. People tell me they've watched the series multiple times. There was such variety in that character. He was earnest and stupid. He was funny and heartbroken. I'm proud of that part. Where would you be if comedy hadn't clicked? When I was young, I really liked being in the out-of-doors, hiking and walking in the forest, so I actually thought for a short while about being a forest ranger. I thought that was a great job and a cool thing to do. Have you exhausted the character now? One of the reasons I got into show business is I like moving from project to project, from problem to problem. So even doing Saul as long as I did was a little tough for me. It's like, let's just move on and do something else. As good as it was while it lasted, and as much as I wanted to see where the story went, I like the next thing I do to be 180 degrees from the thing I just did. You had a heart attack on the Better Call Saul set. How did that affect your outlook? Having a heart attack like that is a level of reality check that you might struggle to find if you didn't have an incident like that. It gave me this impetus to work on myself and work on my choices in my life going forward, to do things that I value. How did you bounce back? I had 5 weeks off, but there were still a few months where I needed more rest than I was used to. Now I do my workouts and take my statins and check in with my heart doctor every other year or so. What led you to segue into action roles? It was very much a planned quirk to try action. My thought was, I've been a comedy writer for 25 years. I hadn't really used my body except to eat chicken and make jokes. I started to train and then put the word out that I was up for an action film. Derek Kolstad, who wrote the John Wick films, liked my idea and wrote a film called Nobody. I did not like going to the gym. I avoided it. But when I said I would do this, I really needed to focus on becoming stronger physically and more agile. In your latest action film, you have some intense scenes. What's it like to film those? Action fighting sequences are a lot like a sketch. You have to work as a group, and even though it's choreographed, it changes when you're right there. You see all the blood in these movies. It's fake blood, and it makes us laugh as much as it makes you laugh. Do you have any hobbies? I play guitar. Not well. I like to read. I like to create things. I've got some kids' book ideas. I could work on a movie script or two, but I'm trying not to be in work mode all the time. You've been married for 28 years. What's your secret? Years ago, I saw an interview with the longest married couple in America. They had been married 75 years, and they asked them, "What was your secret?" The woman said, "He works on oil rigs." The point of it was, he was not in the house for 6 months out of the year. What is the secret? Marry the right person. Good luck. Your children, Nate and Aaron, are on their own now, and you are an empty nester. How have you coped with that? Not well. That's hard. To be honest, I'm a little lost without kids to help to be around. I gotta figure it out, but I'm trying to enjoy it. If you have a lot of freedom, but yeah, trying to figure it out. You get to work with them, though. I'm working with my son on a TV project. My daughter and I put out a book of kids' rhymes that we wrote and she illustrated, so we do work together. How did growing up in Illinois with 6 siblings shape your identity? When you become somewhat famous, people say, oh, you're just a Hollywood guy. And you're like, how am I a Hollywood guy? I'm a Naperville guy, running around fighting over the last piece of cake or wishing we could go to Pizza Hut. I feel very shaped by my Naperville Boy Scout Catholic 7 kids childhood. I'm that guy at heart. And finally, what do you love about being in your 60s? You can exhale a little bit. Whatever you are, whatever you've made, however you behave, this is it. The idea of building this into something much, much bigger, that weight is off your shoulders. And now let's look at a couple of articles from the Seniors Guide magazine. This one, Healthy Benefits of Melons, by Anthea Levy. When Americans think of melons, we typically picture cantaloupes, honeydew melons, and watermelons. However, dozens of different types of melons grow globally, such as gourd-like bitter melon from India and the sweet canary melon from Asia and Africa. Keep reading for 4 impressive health benefits of melons. Benefits of melons from inside to out. 1. A great source of antioxidants. Melons are excellent sources of antioxidant, naturally occurring molecules that help scavenge harmful compounds in the body called free radicals. If left to run free, free radicals heighten oxidative stress and damage tissues over time. A greater intake of antioxidant-rich foods has been associated with a lower risk of developing chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease and cancer. Each type of melon delivers a different antioxidant profile. Cantaloupe, for example, is a great source of beta-carotene, a provitamin that gets converted into vitamin A in the body and supports vision and reproductive health. Watermelon serves up notable antioxidants as well. The melon is rich in lycopene, the same antioxidant that gives food like tomatoes and grapefruits their vibrant color. While findings have been mixed, some studies report that a higher lycopene intake is associated with a lower risk of developing prostate cancer. They promote hydration. About 20% of our hydration needs are actually met through food, not the water we drink. Luckily, melons are among the most hydrating fruits around, with varieties like cantaloupe and watermelon clocking in at 90% water by weight. Melons' sky-high water content makes them perfect snacks for staying hydrated. They support immune health. All 3 of the most popular types of melons are good sources of vitamin C, another antioxidant. Vitamin C, in particular, supports a healthy immune system by stimulating the production of white blood cells and enhancing their action against foreign invaders. On the flip side, research shows that low levels of vitamin C are associated with a greater susceptibility to illnesses and infection. Fortunately, you don't need to eat an entire melon to keep your immune system on tip-top shape. Just 1 cup of cubed cantaloupe fulfills 65% of your daily vitamin C needs. And finally, they're good for skin health. When it comes to melons, the saying, "You are what you eat," might just apply. That's because both the high vitamin C and water content of melons are critical for healthy growing skin. Vitamin C assists in the production of the most abundant protein in the body, collagen. Collagen supports skin elasticity and also aids in wound healing. When you get a cut, proteins like collagen are responsible for remodeling the tissues at the wound site. As you age, declining collagen stores contribute to the formation of wrinkles. Health delivers relevant information in clear, jargon-free language that puts health into context in people's lives. You can look for it online at www.health.com. And now, from the same source, let's look at lessons on longevity from women's longer lifespans. Genetics may give women a head start to live longer, but lifestyle habits help too. All of us can take lessons on longevity from women and their healthy choices. It's a fact that women live longer than men. However, that longevity gap in the United States has become wider, according to a study published in the January 2024 issue of JAMA Internal Medicine. The difference in life expectancy between men and women increased to 5.8 years in 2021, the latest year for which data is available, the largest gap since 1996. Today, the average woman lives to approximately age 81, and the average man to approximately age 76, according to recent figures from the CDC. Why the gap? In many cases, women are better than men at addressing certain health needs that contribute to longer lives, said Alan Geller, a senior lecturer on social and behavioral science at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, who was part of the 2024 study's research team. However, there is no reason why men shouldn't live as long as women. Men can learn some valuable lessons from women about longevity. Here are some areas that the study found that have the greatest impact on men's lives and how women handle them differently. Weight gain. The JAMA study found that heart disease and diabetes were two leading contributors to men's shorter lives. While there are many risk factors linked to heart disease and diabetes, weight gain can have the most wide-ranging effects, as it can lead to high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and insulin resistance. Compared with women, men generally have a higher risk for and prevalence of heart disease until after age 75, according to the CDC. Obesity and rates for adults ages 60 and older are similar between men and women. However, there's evidence that women tend to be more concerned than men about excess weight. They're more likely than men to join weight loss programs, take prescription weight loss drugs, and stick with a plant-based diet, says Geller. Lung cancer. The study found that lung cancer deaths were higher among men. Smoking continues to be the leading cause of lung cancer, and while fewer people smoke nowadays, men are still more likely than women to light up. In 2021, 13.1% of men reported smoking a cigarette either every day or some days, compared with 10.1% of women. Research has found that women have a harder time quitting than men do, but they are more motivated to make several attempts at quitting. Men are also more likely to have smoked longer before quitting. Melanoma. The study found that men are almost twice as likely as women to die from melanoma, a statistic that is also supported by the American Cancer Society. Melanoma is the deadliest type of skin cancer, but when it's caught early, it rarely kills. Geller points out that women are more likely than men to wear sunscreen daily and are more proactive about getting regular dermatology checkups. They are also more diligent about regular skin self-checks and having any suspicious spots looked at. Melanoma is usually visible as a large dark skin spot. It may appear anywhere on the body, but it most commonly develops on the back, chest, or leg. Mental health. Suicide rates among adults ages 55 to 64 are almost 8 times higher for men than women. Even though older women experience higher rates of depression than older men, they are more likely to seek treatment like therapy and medication. Many men feel an external pressure to appear strong, which makes them reluctant to talk about their mental health struggles or to seek help, says Geller. Another problem is that depression can look different in men than in women, which is why it can often go undetected. Women usually have symptoms like sadness, feeling of worthlessness, and anxiety. Men, on the other hand, may express depression through anger, irritability, substance abuse, and risky behaviors. Other signs of depression that men should be mindful about include the following: loss of enjoyment in favorite activities, persistent sad or empty mood, increased boredom and apathy, fatigue, loss of energy, restlessness and irritability, insomnia or spending too much time in bed, feelings of hopelessness or pessimism, trouble concentrating or making decisions, and unintentional weight gain or loss. And finally, love and longevity. Multiple studies have shown that married men tend to live longer than single men. Married men and those in committed relationships are more likely to benefit from the protective effect of being a couple, says Alan Geller of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. These men are also more likely to learn lessons on longevity from women. A partner can encourage them to follow a healthier lifestyle, pursue other preventive health measures, and seek timely medical evaluation for new symptoms. In addition, their commitment to the responsibilities of marriage or a relationship usually makes men less likely to take physical risks or abuse drugs and alcohol. The author of this piece, Matthew Solon, is executive editor of Harvard Men's Health Watch. And now to AARP the magazine, and back to the article, the final part of Money Stress and How to Tame It. This is part three. It's how to be a calm investor. A market historian shares what he's learned about surviving scary times. This interview was by Penelope Wang. If you want to navigate today's financial uncertainty, a knowledge of economic history can help. Someone with that knowledge is William Bernstein, an investment advisor and author of The Four Pillars of Investing and other books about investing and financial history. He's been honored for his work by the premier global association of financial analysts, and he regularly speaks at industry conferences. We ask him what history has to teach us about managing our finances. Question: with the stock market at record highs, should we be worried about a downturn? There are warning signs to consider. We have a government that is encouraging speculation in investments such as crypto or certain stocks. We've never seen that before in the U.S., except perhaps with 19th century railway speculation. I'm hearing people boast that they're 100% in stocks, which is the zeitgeist you see at market tops. For the past several decades, we had an independent Federal Reserve that helped keep a lid on inflation at a cost to the economy. Now, we seem to be returning to the 70s and 60s when presidents tried to dominate Federal chairs to keep rates low. Back then, we had Lyndon Johnson clashing with William McChesney Martin, Jr., and Richard Nixon browbeating Arthur Burns. Those efforts did not work out well, as inflation eventually soared. But the warning signs don't tell you when it's time to sell. Bubbles can last a long time, and some other type of event may cause markets to drop. Of course, no one should try to time the market. But a long-term perspective on investing history helps you identify the warning signs and make sure you're prepared to ride out crashes which are inevitable. What is the best way to protect your finances in a downturn? The most important lesson that I've learned is that you don't design your investment portfolio based on normal stock and bond returns. You design it with the worst-case scenario in mind, such as the stock market downturns in 1929 or 1981 or 2009. History shows that the worst returns may happen only 2% of the time, but that 2% outcome can wreck your finances, especially if you panic and sell at the bottom. The second most important thing I've learned is that compounding is magic, and you should never interrupt it. It's essential to leave your money invested to grow over time. And what's most likely to interrupt compounding? Panicking and selling in a worst-case scenario. That means you should hold a portfolio that is much more conservative than you might think, since you're more likely to stick with it in tough times. If your ideal portfolio is, say, 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds, you may want to shift closer to a 55-45 or 50-50 mix, depending on your circumstances. What is the biggest risk that could derail our finances? The biggest risk to investors in almost any historical period is inflation. We've all seen what happened in Argentina today or in the last century. Germany's Weimar Republic, when inflation ran rampant. Even the United States has had some really scary periods, including after World War I and during the 70s, when inflation hit double-digit rates. A good way to make sure your retirement income keeps up with inflation is to include Treasury Inflation-Protected Securities, or TIPS, in your portfolio. These Treasury bonds are designed to track inflation as measured by the Consumer Price Index. You can buy TIPS through a brokerage firm. You can build a ladder of TIPS with maturities in every year, which is what I'm doing. A free website, tipsladder.com, can help with that. But if you prefer to keep things simple, you can opt for a TIPS mutual fund. It's best to keep TIPS, that's T-I-P-S, in a tax-sheltered account, since interest is paid monthly and you will pay for federal taxes on the inflation adjustment. And last question, how can you reduce financial stress during market upheavals? You have to plan for them. There will always be times when the markets don't deliver the returns you expected. They may even collapse. It's hard not to react emotionally and be tempted to sell if you see your portfolio drop 40% or 50%, as happened in the global financial crisis of 2007 to 2009. To help lower that anxiety, you need to be keeping enough money in safe assets to cover your spending needs during a downturn. That way, you'll be able to sleep at night knowing you can pay your essential living costs, such as mortgage, gas, and groceries, despite drops in the stock market. If you're retired, a prolonged downturn could reduce your retirement income. So, if at all possible, try to have several years' worth of cash and high-quality fixed-income assets to meet your essential spending needs. And if you have built enough savings to see you through retirement, there's less need to take additional risk in stocks. You've won the game, so stop playing. Penelope Wang is an award-winning personal finance journalist who has worked at Consumer Reports and Money Magazine. Now let's look at the lifelong cruiser, Ted Eastwick, 68. This Miami Beach resident has been on ocean crossings since he was 2 years old when he went with his family on a voyage from New York to Italy. His mother disliked air travel. Now the owner of an executive search firm, Eastwick puts his lifetime cruise tally at more than 150, including 80 transatlantic trips on various lines. He continues to take about 2 cruises a year. What he has learned. I live by the motto that friends made at sea tend to last forever. The remarkable thing about travel by sea, we're all in it together, one for all and all for one. So be open to talking with people. I met a couple from Chicago on a transatlantic cruise on the Queen Mary II in 2005. 20 years later, we have sailed on 10 cruises together and visit one another in Miami and Chicago. Exult in being at sea. Some cruises have a port a day, but if you have the opportunity when at sea to sit in a lounge chair, looking at the wake or listening to it, plowing through the Atlantic, the Mediterranean, the Caribbean, the Indian Ocean, and you know that everyone who sailed that, the Portuguese, Columbus, the Vikings, Magellan, had that same view as you, wow, that does put life into perspective. And having just returned from a cruise, I can second that motion. The River Cruise Executive, Rudy Schreiner, 73. Schreiner is co-founder and former CEO of Amma Waterways River Cruises, which operates boats in Europe, Asia, Africa, Central America, and South America. Since 1993, he has been on about 200 trips. Currently company chairman, he continues to cruise with his wife and fellow co-founder, Kristen Karst, 59. What he has learned. You can explore on your own. On a river cruise, group excursions are included in the fare, but guests can create personal experiences. Get advice from the cruise manager. Ask what to see in a city, how to get there, and any local tips. When packing for a river cruise, think in layers. European weather can change quickly, so buildable layers let you stay comfortable. Don't overpack. Laundry service on board is usually inexpensive, and packing light gives you more room for souvenirs. Travel in off seasons. Europe in summer versus February is completely different. In winter, there are fewer crowds and more chances to feel like a local, enjoy a cafe, or take your time in museums. And we have a quote from him. I grew up by the Danube. It's in my blood. It was the right time to slow down a little, but my passion for the rivers hasn't changed. And there's a picture of them in Egypt on the Nile. And we have one more quick item. The resident traveler, Andrea Newman, 67, the retired airline executive and her husband, Frank, 77, bought an apartment on the World Residences at Sea in 2017. They spend 6 to 9 months each year at sea and the rest of the year at their homes in Michigan and Utah. She's learned to pack less than you think you need. Ship life is low maintenance, a few layers, a pair of day and evening shoes, and a couple of nicer evening outfits go a long way. There's laundry, toiletries, and shops on board. You don't have to be rugged to love expeditions. Well, folks, we have once again run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.